Science created him. Now Chuck Norris must stop him. Welcome to my dojo. This is Kung Fu Pizza Party, and I'm your host, Brandon Knight. And today, I'm keeping things spooky here on the show as I review a film that I think is fairly underrated both as a horror movie and as a Chuck Norris flick, Silent Rage. Here on Kung Fu Pizza Party, I seek to deliver high-flying action in 30 minutes or less and serve up some wisdom one slice at a time, so let's dive right into this. And yes, I think this is a fairly underrated horror movie and Chuck Norris film. You will find better of both. You'll certainly find better horror movies, and you will find better Chuck Norris films. This actually came out during like the peak of Chuck Norris's career. Good Guys Wear Black, A Force of One, I think Invasion USA, Eye for an Eye, all of those have already come out or are coming out right around the same time that Silent Rage hits theaters. So it's kind of this like blip in the Chuck Norris filmography, because this is his one and only, well, as of the recording of this, one and only horror film to date, though another horror film starring Chuck Norris, Zombie Plane, is in post-production. It allegedly is supposed to be coming out before the end of the year, but I think it's one of those. It's been advertised to come out for a while now. But anyway, at least as of the recording of this episode, this is Chuck Norris's one and only horror film. Apparently, it wasn't that he didn't enjoy making the movie, but there was something about the final product of it being a horror movie that he just didn't enjoy. Chuck Norris liked his violence in different ways. So you'll find better of both. But what I wrote in my Letterboxd review, which you can follow the show over there, Kung Fu Pizza PRTY, is that this movie has a lot of good pieces to it, but it just needed better execution. I think a lot of this actually has to fall on the director, if I'm being honest. Someone who has made a career doing horror movies, I think if they took the pieces, the good parts of Silent Rage, they could actually turn it into something awesome. Because let's face it, it's a billion-dollar idea. That line I opened the show with today is a line that was on a lot of the movie posters. Like, that is the most Chuck Norris line for a movie possible. Of the only thing standing between us and scientific advancement is Chuck Norris. Chuck Norris's tears cure cancer. It's just a real shame he doesn't cry, though he does get close in this movie. But it's a billion-dollar idea. Chuck Norris versus a reanimated, indestructible corpse. It's brilliant. And the final fight between the two makes a lot of sense from like a fight, combat, a storytelling perspective. Like the final fight between Chuck Norris and the killer in this movie, John Kirby, it makes a lot of sense. It's a billion-dollar idea, but it's just like lacking in certain areas. This is usually a pretty easy film to find on streaming. It's actually a lot of Chuck Norris's films, honestly, are pretty easy to find on streaming. I watched it on the Roku channel. You can watch it there, or if you want a different take on the film, Tubi actually has the Riff Tracks version of Silent Rage, which probably reinforces the fact that this movie is typically not enjoyed and is definitely, I don't want to say I have a hot take saying that I like this movie, because I have met other people who do really like this movie. I think it's just more popular to poke fun at it. There, like I said, it's not perfect. There's a lot of good pieces to it, and there are parts of it that, yeah, it doesn't make sense. It's not very good. For example, there's this whole B plot in this movie. I'll get to the actual main plot here in a bit, but there's this whole B plot in this movie where Chuck Norris is the sheriff of a small town, and a biker gang shows up, and they're like, yeah, we're gonna, you know, cause mischief and revelry and the whole, you know, we're gonna do bad things. So Chuck Norris shows up at the bar they hang out at and just cleans house. It's a great Chuck Norris bar fight. He's the only person on the planet who can do flying running jump sidekicks and be perfectly fine in a bar fight. One of the best shots is a guy, he's got his motorcycle in the bar, and he's gonna, like, there's a table that's kind of fallen over, so he's gonna escape by driving it up this table and jumping out a window. And as he's going through, Chuck Norris picks up a pool stick, flips it around, and hits him with the heavy end so it doesn't break, but he just beefs him over. I think he hits him in the chest, but either way, like, my teeth still are rattling thinking about, like, how much that would hurt driving. He wasn't going fast, but still, like, forward momentum on a motorcycle. Here's the heavy, blunt end of a pool stick smacking me by the incredibly strong Chuck Norris. Like, that would just, I get a concussion just thinking about it. But as awesome as the fight is, all of that has absolutely nothing to do with the main plot of this film. There is no tie back in. There is no, the killer was actually a part of this gang. Nothing. It's a random B plot that gets wrapped up within the first, like, I don't know, 20 to 30 minutes of the movie. Like, it has nothing to do with anything else other than, here's a scene showcasing Chuck Norris's fighting. And it's a Chuck Norris movie. And so, as great as Chuck Norris is, and as awesome as his fight scenes can be, we all don't watch Chuck Norris films for the acting. Let's be honest. Like, we don't watch these movies for excellent line delivery. Like, that's just not what we're here for. That's not Chuck Norris's movies, both him and usually the people he's surrounded by, the acting is fine. So to me, it's just low-hanging fruit to poke fun at the acting in a Chuck Norris movie, because that's just to be expected, especially by this point. Like I said, so many of his classics have already come out by the time Silent Rage comes out that it's like, we know what to expect here. We know, yeah. On the horror side of things, again, there's just, like, these bits that are lacking that could have been better if in the hands of a director who is more familiar with this style. A lot of the heavy lifting in this movie by way of the horror element is done by the music. The music is actually very good and creates a lot of tension. And when there is not music in a scene, normally that's done to, like, add tension. It actually doesn't. It, like, just kind of makes the scene a little flatter. So the music does a lot of heavy lifting. There were so basically this movie falls roughly in the slasher category, kind of serial killer kind of category. And when I watch those movies, which those are my favorite, I love slashers. Either I'm going to watch a slasher or, like, a classic Universal monster movie. Those are my favorite kinds of horror films. And so when I watch a slasher movie, I am buckled in for jump scares every 2 minutes, right? And there were just so many times where I was like, that could have been a jump scare. That could have been a jump scare. That should have definitely been a jump scare. And but the lack of them, you know how some horror movies are, like, they'll make you think there's going to be a jump scare, building to an even jumpier scare later. But it was just like, oh no, you're just not adding jump scares. Lame. And also, maybe this is just a me thing, but when I watch a slasher flick, I fully anticipate there being an awesome chase scene. There needs to be a scene where the killer is chasing the victim. Think the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that what I think is a brilliantly shot scene where Leatherface has got the chainsaw over his head and he's chasing the girl through, like, a cornfield, I think it was. And there's two angles the scene is shot from. One is kind of this, like, diagonal angle, so you can see that there's actually like a good amount of space between Leatherface and the victim. But then there's this second shot where it looks like it's like a front view, and it just looks like Leatherface is just towering over her and it's just going to consume her. That's a good chase scene. The Scream 5, the remake Scream, at the party for Wes, there is a scene, I can't remember the character's name, but he's like jacked up his ankle, I think. He's got like a broken ankle or something, and he's limping, and there's like a shed in the background, and Ghostface just pops out and is just charging full sprint at this guy. That's a good chase scene. And chase scenes don't even have to be like running scenes either. Think like the iconic Halloween, Lori is trying to get back into her house, and you just see Michael Myers slowly crossing the street, just slowly inching closer and closer. There was just a general lack of good chase scenes. There was one in particular where John Kirby is like in this hallway, and there's kind of this silhouette around. He's like in a shadow, but you can see the outline of him, and the victim is standing at the end trying to figure out like, oh, is that him? And I was like, oh, this would be great. It could be like Kirby is starting to walk slowly and then picking up the pace and then like just full on running to take down. No, they don't do that. It's just kind of like this casual, and then they meet up in the middle of the hallway and the guy gets killed. So there's good bits, and the good bits come from the overarching plot, I would say. But then there's just these parts that's like, oh, you could have had it. Just like maybe in the hands of a better director, producer, a more experienced actor. I don't know. It just could have been really, really good. The director actually wanted to turn this into a whole franchise. And the movie does end on the classic, oh, the monster didn't die angle that, you know, these kinds of movies have to have. Every horror movie has to have a good first installment, a pretty decent sequel, 5 very bad and unnecessary sequels, 1 It's So Bad It's Good, Jason Takes Manhattan, and a later reboot that makes you go, why did they do this? That is how all horror movie franchises are supposed to work. Looking at you, Rob Zombie Halloween. But the director wanted to make this into a whole franchise, but again, because Chuck Norris was like, yeah, this isn't for me, which is fine. Pete did fairly well for himself without going full horror. It just kind of died on the cutting room floor, even though, again, there's plenty of examples of, you know, 5 unnecessary sequels that don't have the original cast in it. So there is that. I guess good for them to not just keep plowing forward with more average horror films. But the overall plot of this movie, I think, is where, again, the billion-dollar idea really gets put into place. Though I will say, from the get-go, it does start in a pretty, for some, very distasteful place. So Silent Rage is a movie about a man named John Kirby who is going through a mental health crisis and snaps, resulting in him murdering his landlord. The police arrive, led by Sheriff Chuck Norris, who apprehends Kirby. Kirby escapes police custody and is shot dead. He ends up in the hands of the medical examiner, who uses an experimental drug to reanimate John Kirby back to life, also endowing him with invulnerability, regenerative ability. So anything that comes his way, bullets, the whole bit, Chuck Norris's epic round kicks, just in a matter of moments, he heals and is back at it. And he goes on a murderous rampage as a result. And therefore, when you get to the billion-dollar fight scene of Chuck Norris, the man who has already by this point established himself as this like dominating, powerful, one kick's going to knock you out person in all of his other films, is going up against a guy who can't die again. He's going up against somebody that no matter what he does, this guy just keeps getting back up. And it's kind of explained better than in other horror movies where it's like, why is this guy still going? You know, Scream rules of like, you have to shoot the killer in the head in order to stop them kind of thing. This, no matter what, how, no matter what Chuck Norris does in this fight, Kirby just keeps getting back up because of this drug that brought him back to life. Ultimately, spoilers for a 40 year old film. Spoilers for a 40 year old film. Chuck Norris gets him trapped in a well, and he like falls to the bottom of this well, and it's presumed that he is dead, but the cliffhanger ending is that Kirby pops out of the water and it free frames on him like screaming, jumping out of the water. Yes, they did take a page out of the original Friday the 13th for that closing shot, but you may be thinking that's not the only film they took a page out of with that. So Reanimator came out in 1985 and Maniac Cop in 1988. Silent Rage came out in 1982. So actually this movie predates both of them, that I feel like you could definitely see, you could maybe assume that there was some influence on those films in this movie. It actually predates both of them by several years in the case of Maniac Cop. One movie that it doesn't predate, though, is the original Halloween. It's kind of a safe bet to assume that Michael Myers played an influence on the character of John Kirby. There's even a scene where Chuck Norris knocks him out of a window of a like several-story hospital, and you see Chuck Norris look out the window and you see Kirby's body on the ground. And I was fully anticipating the shot from the final scene of Halloween. Chuck Norris turns, looks away, looks back, and the body's gone. That doesn't happen, but I thought that's what they were going to do because it did just look a lot like that closing shot of the OG Halloween. According to the director, though, the major influence was for John Kirby actually came from Frankenstein. Dr. Frankenstein and Frankenstein's monster are supposed to be big influences on the relationship between John Kirby and this scientist that reanimates him. And there is a really good scene where even though they have figured out that Kirby is committing all of these murders, the scientist is trying to like defend him, protect him, the whole bit. And so there's a scene where Kirby like comes into the office of the scientist, and the scientist is like, you know, oh, you know, he like actually like goes to hug Kirby. He's kind of got like his hands on his cheeks. You know, it's supposed to be like this creator creation loving moment, and Kirby goes to put his hand on the scientist's face and just snaps his neck and leaves him for dead. Like, it's just, it's brutal. It is a very good scene. And again, just like in Frankenstein, kind of that commentary of like, don't dabble in God's domain. Leave dead people alone, please. But right from the get-go, you could be triggered by this film because it does use what is often referred to as the one bad day trope. And this is a trope used in movies where basically, people who are experiencing a mental health crisis or have like a chronic mental illness, they're just one bad day away from snapping and going on a murderous rampage. This was a main trope used in The Joker, starring Joaquin Phoenix. And the Joker situation, let me back up for a second before I jump into that. I am part of the mental health community. I've gone through a lot over the since high school. Just a lot of healing, a lot of brokenness, a lot of different things that not really the place to air all of that right now. But I watch movies like this, and it puts me in weird situations. I know with the Joker, there were a lot of people who watched that movie and became very passionate about how we need to be taking better care of people with mental illnesses, making therapy more accessible, therapy and medication more accessible. And they had a lot of passion and vigor, and then opening weekend finished and we moved on to something else. But I do know other people who are also a part of the mental health community that actually very much dislike the Joker because of its perpetuation of this trope, this stereotype that people who are mentally ill are one bad day away from committing acts of murder. And I can see where people in the community get to that place, because it does happen a lot in movies where the person with the mental illness does do terrible things. I don't want to like defend the Joker because it's not a perfect movie, but there is a little bit of like, I don't hate it. And it's not because Joaquin Phoenix puts on a great performance, which he does, but it's because I actually learned something about myself from watching that movie. I actually like discovered I have, and especially when that movie came out, I had a defense mechanism, a coping mechanism that Joaquin Phoenix has in that movie. And I had never realized it until I watched this movie and like explored what it was. And I was like, oh my gosh, I've been doing this for literally my entire life. I never knew this was a defense mechanism. So like, I understand if somebody disdains that film, if somebody hates that movie, like they have permission to, but there is for me a little bit of like, I actually grew and learned something about myself and was able to heal a little bit because of that movie, as opposed to a movie like 10 to Midnight. So I love Charles Bronson. I'm sure I'll talk about Charles Bronson more on this show at some point. I'm going to cut it close on this time limit in this episode. But in 10 to Midnight, there's a serial killer in a college town who strips naked before he kills his victims. It's just part of the movie. And the closing shot of the film is Charles Bronson has got this guy cornered, and he starts launching into this whole thing of like, what are you gonna do, arrest me? I'm sick, I'm ill, I'm just gonna plead insanity, get off on a light charge, be a good little boy, get off on parole, get back on the streets even quicker. You can't stop me, I'm sick. And Charles Bronson says something to the effect of, like hell I will, and shoots him in the head. And that is more egregious to me than the Joker, because that is like, what do we do with mentally ill people? We kill them. And that actually like hits closer to home, I think, because we have moments in the real world where police officers just drop the ball and kill people who are mentally ill, who aren't getting the proper treatment. I watch a movie like 10 to Midnight or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is actually like a good movie and does a lot of the mental health stuff well. But I watch movies like that and I think to myself, it's the year of our Lord 2025, and things in the mental health world isn't still not great. We could be doing so much more. The church, as a Christian, the church could still be doing so much more. But holy cow, like 50 years ago or more, I would have been lobotomized and shot by this point. Like, there is just this part of me that's like so grateful that I live now as opposed to like 50 years ago or more, because I would have been so... Again, I'm just going off of movies here, but it's like, it was just the mental illness was treated so differently. I will say though, when it comes to Silent Rage, though it starts at this point of the one bad day trope, there are some pivots that they do along the way that I think kind of redeem itself a little bit. Yes, they do shoot John Kirby when he tries to escape, but what fully happens is that Kirby knocks over an officer, their gun goes off, and then other officers, thinking he fired, start firing. All the while, Chuck Norris and Kirby's therapist are screaming, "What are you doing? Don't fire. Nobody said to fire. What are you doing? Don't kill him." You know, the whole bit. Along with that, John Kirby's therapist is much different from the therapist in The Joker, who does not give a rip about Joaquin Phoenix. John Kirby's therapist actually carries a lot of, like, weight, a lot of grief for the passing of his patient. He apologizes to Chuck Norris. No, he didn't realize that, like, Kirby had gotten that ill. He, you know, when the scientist is trying to reanimate him, he's like, "What are you doing? Just let him die in peace. Just let him go. Like, it's better this way." And, you know, he's like grieving with his wife later in the movie. Like, you just see, like, actual remorse, not like failure on his end, but like remorse for what happened to his patient. And when Kirby is reanimated, he's basically zombie form. I don't think you can really pin the rest of the murders on the one bad day trope, because he's just like a reanimated killing machine zombie at that point. So that's Silent Rage, and I am really cutting it close here on time. Although I was able to talk about everything I wanted to on this episode, so that's good. Would I watch Silent Rage again? Yes. This is not a yearly spooky watch for me. I kind of have like a set group of movies that I like watching every spooky season. This isn't one of them, but I could see coming back to it in the future. This isn't the first time I've watched this movie, and I would own it. I think I would, you know, if I came across it at like a resale DVD shop or something for a couple bucks, I definitely would pick it up. But thank you all for listening to today's episode. If you haven't yet already, please rate and review this show wherever you get your podcasts. Pass this episode along to a friend. Follow the show on Instagram at Kung Fu Pizza Party. Check out my YouTube channel, Studio 219, a place for faith and pop culture. And check out the other great shows here on the Anna Zhao Ministries podcast network, like Systematic Geekology, Why I Don't Like, and Friday Night Frights, to keep the spooky season vibes a-going. I'll see you all in the next episode. This has been Kung Fu Pizza Party, where I've delivered high-flying action in 30 minutes or less by the skin of my teeth here, and served up some wisdom one slice at a time.